GPT-4 can enable biology PhDs to develop bioweapons, and found that it increased their success rate at producing successful plans by about 400%. Their characterization of it was different, but the particular thing was, and it's a little bit similar to the era when a human plus a computer was the most proficient way to play chess.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Artificial intelligence, AI, stands at the forefront of technological evolution, with experts predicting that it could add trillions of dollars to our GDP, but it could also negatively impact our workforce and national security. So how do we regulate it without stifling innovation? Our podcast features insights from various perspectives. We have had industry leaders, government officials, leaders of advocacy groups, and think tanks. Together, they address pivotal questions that are needed to create practical legislation. I'm very excited to have Daniel Coulson with us today. He's the founder and executive director of the AI Policy Institute, a think tank that researches and advocates for government policies to mitigate extreme risk from frontier AI technologies. Prior to AIPI, Daniel co-founded Reserve in 2017. A company focused on offering financial services in high inflation currency regions. I invited him to this show as we want to have many different voices that can create practical legislation. And having the voice of a leading AI think tank can be useful for our listeners. Welcome, Daniel. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the Regulating AI podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, Sanjay. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Daniel, October 30th, President Biden issued a sweeping executive order on artificial intelligence. Can you give us your feedback on it?
Absolutely. So I really thought that the executive order was a step in the right direction at the right moment. A lot of the order was focused on getting information. And there's a few dozen different reports that were commissioned in different agencies and departments, really focusing on trying to understand what is happening with AI right now, what is the opportunity that we have, and what are the potential risks and security challenges that we might face. So, you know, in that sense, I think the executive order was appropriately preparatory, where it's positioning government to get ready to manage this coming wave of new technological advances that a lot of people are anticipating. And I think with any type of regulation, you risk poorly targeted regulation. And so as the government is trying to figure out how should we regulate AI, that there's a risk that you don't end up targeting the harms, that the regulations mostly end up having negative effects for economic growth or things like that. And so you really want to make sure that we have the information that we need. I think, and my organization focuses on the security risks associated with frontier AI technology. The vast majority of AI has no significant risk or a kind of thing that should be concerning. It's things like algorithms that classify transaction data for your bank. That's not something that could take over the government or change warfare or something like that. But there's a very narrow and small class of models that really do have that application. Figuring out the software for piloting massive drone swarms is a notable new weapon of mass destruction, for example, with that being a notably software-enabled technology, with the current breakthroughs in deep learning being essential for driving that. And so in the executive order, I thought that one thing I thought was really excellent was the classification of models using a compute threshold as the primary distinction for a certain category of high-risk models. It's only above at very high compute thresholds that you're creating these models that have very general capabilities. They're applicable in essentially any domain that you could think of. And they also require huge amounts of resources in order to develop. Those models require a very particular type of response that's very different than small models or less powerful open source models. And just a final comment is I think Congress is really teed up to take the next step. And we're working hard with our partners to figure out what exactly that should be.
You gave us a lot of information that I've got some follow-on questions. We will talk about Congress later on because we are in DC, so we have to talk about Congress. So your point was that it's the frontier models that you worry about, and the risk-based analysis that the executive order laid out is important. When you look at the biggest risks, it's mainly you're talking about the frontier models, you talk about the drone swarms. Now, how do we balance innovation in AI with responsible development and use, Daniel?
So to start with, I think it's useful to delineate what areas are safe and what areas there's maybe cause for concern, most especially because the vast majority of applications are very safe. I gave this example of kind of bank transaction classification algorithms. Even more, GPT 3.5 level language models have been open source for a year plus now. I think that's a reasonably strong evidence that models like that don't pose very severe short-run security risks. And that's something that's really useful to take into account as we're trying to figure out for future frontier models that are being released and developed, where exactly should we put the thresholds and limits for what's too risky and what's actually good. But so to start with, I think it's these general purpose frontier models that have, I think, special risk characterizations of risks. One example of this is OpenAI released a report recently looking at the degree to which GPT-4 can enable biology PhDs to develop bioweapons and found that it increased their success rate at producing successful plans by about 400%. Their characterization of it was different, but the particular thing was, and it's a little bit similar to the era when a human plus a computer was the most proficient way to play chess. I think right now we're in a similar era where the most effective way to do science is a human plus a computer. And so if you imagine any biology expert augmented with a frontier model, a truly frontier model, they will just perform much better. That obviously has dual use applications. And then you just run into the problem where AI isn't a consumer technology. It's being developed by consumer oriented companies in a lot of ways. But when it's able to do science that's being directly applied to weapon systems, it's just a much bigger can of worms. And so that's the can of worms that we're opening and everyone's worried about and trying to deal with.
That's true. Daniel, a couple of points that you mentioned. You said it's 3.5 or equivalent, you're not as concerned because they can do banking-related transactions. Mark Zuckerberg, about a month ago, came out and said that they're going to release Llama 3, which all indications are it's going to be for ChatGPT 4.0 equivalent or more. And he even said that they might release AGI in the future as an open source because there is a debate on open source. And then you have Mistral and a few others that are releasing these open source. Does that concern you? You were not concerned about 3.5, but now we're getting into 4 and beyond range where, as you said, some of these bio experts will have that. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so you're touching on a couple really important issues. I think one component is as these frontier models continue to scale, where exactly are we going to encounter very powerful and dangerous capabilities? And then separately, how should we think about whether or not to be open sourcing those models? Just starting with the open source question, I've found that the history of Stability AI's open source image models has been a really useful case study for how open source dynamics work, especially around abuse, where there have been very large online communities that have dedicated to the fine tuning of their open source models for the production of photorealistic child pornography, and which I think of as roughly the maximally abusive application of an image model. If you think of image models as a technology, this is the upper bound roughly. So you would imagine that you wouldn't have that, or at least insofar as you can restrict it, that companies would go about putting in place restrictions. The problem is that it's not possible to enforce any content restrictions for any open source model. And the reason for this is because let's say that you train an image model and you exclude pornographic images from the training set. You might think that leads to a model that can't produce pornographic images. The truth is that if you open source that model, you can, with a home computer and maybe a few hundred dollars, modify that algorithm, or sorry, modify that model such that it retains all of the capabilities it developed in training, photorealistic abilities. You type in text and it really creates the image. What you do is you then just retrain it, adding in pornographic images, and now it has all of the pornographic abilities. More specifically with CSAM material production, they'll have put together their own training sets. You combine a training set like that with Stability AI's open source models, and now you have what I think of as a toxic chemical waste spill of software release in terms of harms, where you have a single point of release that has a stunningly scaled harms. And I think in that sense, I feel uncertain about how to manage the open source issues because you can't maintain any content restrictions. And very notably, Mark Zuckerberg and Jan LeCun have deliberately misled Congress to think that you can. And it was demonstrated during the first Schumer Insight Forum when Mark Zuckerberg claimed this. And then Tristan Harris whipped out his customized bad llama and had it produce instructions for anthrax, which Mark Zuckerberg a minute earlier said was not actually possible with llama. So I think basically, I think if these models really do transform our political world and have very significant security concerns, I have trouble imagining how those models are okay to open source, because that causes them to proliferate to our geopolitical adversaries. It causes it to proliferate to every bad actor, small and large. At the very least, we can choose to open source later in some sense. And there isn't that much harm for choosing to open source a little bit later, especially because we have that choice available, given that it requires hundreds of millions to billions of dollars and tech giant resources to create these systems.
So fair to assume, Daniel, that you're against open sourcing of these models?
Not all open sourcing. I think a strong argument in favor of the essential value of open sourcing is that you need to have access to the open source model in order to understand how it works, in order to do artificial neuroscience in some sense. And so that's essential for safety research. But I think very specifically the absolute frontier models that are pushing the bounds of capabilities, those certainly should not be open sourced right away. And even something that I would suggest is, I think we really have no idea today what the security risk profile of a lot of these models is, because they're not actually being thoroughly tested. For example, I think in order to properly test these models, you want to do so in a classified environment with compute at scale, such that you have access to all of the details there. That's the environment that you can really tell. And right now it's closer to, you know, the AI companies found a biograd to consult with them. It's maybe a bit better. I think they're working very hard to do a lot better than that. And that's not a totally fair characterization, but...
But the White House has invoked the DPA, the Defense Production Act, to force some of these companies, when you talk about these frontier models, to obviously show them the safety and all these other things. But Daniel, your think tank is working on the Hill quite a bit. AI, when you look from a year ago, a little more than a year ago, from the start of ChatGPT 3.5 to 4, the advent of multimodal, the agents, the super agents, how is legislation and how are members of Congress going to keep up with the incredible pace of this technology? It's for tech people. I talk to my friends in tech. They have a hard enough time trying to keep up. How are legislators and regulators, what are your thoughts and how are they going to keep up with regulation and legislation?
It's a lot of changes very quickly, which is something that I think government usually struggles with. One illustration of this is, I think until quite recently, the idea of AGI was seen as a taboo idea or kind of a sci-fi thing, not something that's real and not really something that you can talk about in public or in sort of serious mainstream, at least in Washington. So one way in which I do like that Meta came out and said they want to open source AGI is because it helps with the message to Washington that AGI isn't some sci-fi idea. All of America's leading AI labs have it in their publicly stated objectives and missions to try to develop it. And so I think in some important sense, the technology governance issues from the last few decades haven't really been dealt with yet. Where I think of social media, the privacy issues that have been, and mass surveillance issues that have been suggested by the internet, and now the tech companies scaling into very powerful AI technologies, all of these as being, in some sense, erosions of government power and a transition of power towards the tech companies and also governance responsibility for more and more of society. And all of those issues are stacked on top of each other. And I guess in terms of Congress keeping on top of these things, I think the Schumer Insight Forum were really helpful. It's a great idea by Senate Leader Schumer to focus for 6 months on educating Congress and bringing in all of the experts that we might need and want, helping offices build relationships with experts and bridge the divide between Silicon Valley and Washington, because there's very little overlap between those two. And especially insofar as there is overlap, most of it is the lobbyists of the tech companies and not independent groups that are trying to take a slightly more, maybe slightly less biased stance on some of the tech developments. So that's a long way of saying it's a work in progress.
Yeah. But you again, Daniel, brought up some excellent points, which I want to follow up with you. Senator Schumer had these learning sessions, insight sessions, as you said, for a 6 month period. And there have been other stuff. He brought in tech leaders from Silicon Valley. Where are leaders of community colleges? Where are manufacturing companies? Where are healthcare, rural healthcare companies? You think they're not going to be impacted by AI? Healthcare is key. Rural healthcare access to healthcare is key, and AI can play a huge role. But there are privacy data issues. Manufacturing with robotics is having a ChatGPT moment as we speak. So I understand what, and it's a great first step. But do you think, because you are the guest, not me, that we need more voices here? Because you don't want to AI divide like we have a digital divide in this country, do you?
Absolutely. I think we definitely need more voices. In an important sense, it's right that AI is a platform technology, like a combustion engine or electricity. And in that sense, it's going to touch every industry. It's going to touch every one of our jobs. It's going to transform all of our lives in pretty profound ways. And I think an interesting question that suggests is who should get to decide about those changes? The mode of technological development that we've had has been, you might say, something close to libertarian extremism. When there's a new technology, a company can deploy that technology without any sort of approval or consent for the most part and reaps all of the benefits. That isn't to say that we should switch to some regulatory form where you can't deploy technology, but it's more to say that in other areas of extremely high risk and high impact technology, you have to take the governance issues seriously. And a good example comparison for this is human cloning, not on the basis of international treaty, but on the basis of international stigma. There's been very little creative genetic engineering of humans. And I think a part of that is driven by that none of us should be able to unilaterally create a new human species, create a new country where everyone is born via exclusively artificial birth processes. I think you get subject to all these sudden plausible political nightmare scenarios. And I think at least in the bioethics area and with human cloning, the world has taken an unbelievably conservative stance. I think that's been probably really good. And so I think similarly with kind of this, some of the AI stuff, there's this unilateralism problem where if humans suddenly get displaced by one of Meta's products, it feels like there should have been maybe a different process than just Mark Zuckerberg and Yana Kun making the call.
Looking to make the most out of AI advancements and innovation? Visit regulatingai.org to learn more about how best to optimize the use and integration of AI and sign up for the Regulating AI newsletter to keep up to date with the latest in AI governance and regulation.
Yeah, but then just to follow that point, you have all these Silicon Valley companies that you have seen. They're saying, please regulate us. Some people are saying there could be regulatory capture being done by them because smaller companies are going to have a real hard time trying to meet some of these regulations, or it's expensive. It's making a new drug. It costs billions of dollars to create a large language model. You need all these GPUs and talent. So the question becomes is, are you afraid of any kind of monopolies happening in the AI sector?
The regulatory capture issue is an interesting one. I think most people have become convinced, at least, that Sam Altman is interested in regulation for regulatory capture purposes. I personally think that Sam Altman, that isn't his intention. I think he actually thinks that would be a reasonably good safety policy. That said, there is definitely risk of regulatory capture in the sense of if you need a license to develop a model and you need to know the guy that gives the licenses in order to get that license, then that creates an unfair dynamic. But I would point out a slightly different issue, which is a lot of tech products so far have been consumer products. Venmo or something is a consumer product. The AI models aren't consumer products, or at least they have a stunningly wide range of applications in politics, military applications, et cetera. And so I would maybe say that, and this is actually how I feel about this, because I also want the growth and positive transformation that can be brought by this. But if we don't deal with the problems that it proposes for our society, then we won't get those benefits. You know, and I think the case of 11 Labs' deep fake voice technology being used in a robot call that called hundreds of thousands of voters in New Hampshire, saying that they should save their vote for the general election, don't vote in the primary. That's with Mark Andreessen being the lead investor in that company. That's actually not an okay thing to have happened, that's a major problem. And so I think it's really in these companies' interests in the sense that given that they're building technologies that have such incredible promise, that full scope of applications and concerns needs to be taken seriously because we all want the benefits from this thing, but we don't want to lose our democracy or have all the things get broken in weird ways. And I think people feel that's how social media went, is that we deployed this technology and it broke everything in all of these weird ways. And we're trying to put the pieces back together. And I don't think people want to do that again.
So let me just follow the example of 11 Labs and the robocalls in New Hampshire. So let's say 11 Labs was the technology that was used. There was a company that, again, where it was pushed out through. And as you said, A to Z invested in the company. So if AI causes harm, let's just say in this case, who should be liable? Is 11 Labs liable? The political company that pushed it out? Or where do you assign liability here, Daniel?
That's a great question. And something that's been, I think, at the center of the political conversation recently in terms of what sorts of legislation we might see in the short run. Starting with on the user side of things, things like non-consensual deepfake nudes, I think probably should be illegal. And the user generating those images should certainly be liable for that. That's something that I think issues around Taylor Swift recently have brought into quite a high profile awareness. Similarly, things like following the robocall in New Hampshire, the FCC had a declaratory ruling clarifying that is illegal. That's a case where, again, I think the user should be liable if they use the technology in this way. Generally speaking, though, I think on the user liability question, it usually is a little bit more straightforward because we have a lot of experience with dealing with individual liability questions. And where there's a lot harder questions is on the developer liability side of things. I've generally held the stance that model developers should be liable for the content moderation of their products. And if they can't maintain any content moderation promises, then that's actually not an acceptable level of assurance. If you're putting out voice cloning technology and you can't say, I have no idea if this will be used to call hundreds of thousands of voters, then that's not the appropriate level of care in the deployment of that technology. So in that sense, I think 11 Labs would appropriately be held liable for their technology being used in an extremely abusive manner and for facilitating election interference. Similarly, I think Stability AI should be held liable for the facilitation of the massive scaling of CSAM image production, because it's specifically their image model that's led to the massive scaling of a lot of that. Now, I think there's along these lines, then people might suggest, well, if all of these capabilities are inevitably going to end up in open sourced models, who is the developer in that case? It seems like there's going to be lots and lots of developers releasing these things. And in that sense, that's the way in which we're in a fortunate circumstance where small models are still reasonably safe and the very large models that are coming seem to be the primary threat. And so I think we're actually in a moment where we've seen a bunch of AI technology and have an opportunity to try to make a call and to try to regulate AI and to make it go better. And I think that requires a clear delineation of who's responsible. And the key thing with, I would say, the frontier model developers is that there's a very small number of actors that are able to produce these most powerful general AI systems. And in the pursuit of developing superintelligence, the only path that anyone seriously sees available is taking advantage of the scaling hypothesis and basically dumping billions and billions of dollars of compute and electricity into trying to train these sort of super systems. And for those projects, there's really strange risks involved. And something that I've been strongly supportive of is that those models should have strict liability for catastrophic harms. With strict liability meaning that you don't need to prove negligence on the part of the developer to prove that they're liable for a harm. And the thing I mean by catastrophic harms is harms, let's say, above $100 million of damages. The objective of this type of liability is if Llama 3 is actually used to develop a bioweapon by a bioterrorist, and that leads to 10 million people's deaths, that it should be clear in law that the developer of that model would be liable for each case of harm, with strict liability often being used in circumstances like preventing U.S. corporations from doing business with sanctioned terrorist groups and adversary foreign nations. That's the level of incentive that you're trying to provide for this particular type of harm. I think that given the asymmetric risks that are involved with these most powerful technologies, I think a liability of this type would significantly reduce the likelihood that I think we would see really major risks like this be taken.
Not to make light of the millions of deaths that you talked about, are you concerned that some of this, when you talk about Llama 3, Stability AI, 11 Labs, it could stifle innovation? I mean, that's what kind of is, because there are a lot of good things that are also coming out of 11 Labs in some ways, like voice translation, language translation, and other things. But for just across the board, could it have a chilling effect on innovation in many ways?
I think it could. The thing that I would really like to see is technology developers starting to take the societal impacts of their technology seriously. For example, I think 11 Labs absolutely should have voluntarily implemented KYC processes such that you at least know who the person is that's using the product and deploying it in certain ways, because it's totally foreseeable that this technology will be used for extremely abusive purposes. So in that sense, the thing that I think has been surprising for me to see is a lot of technology developers just don't believe that their technology has these impacts, or maybe thinks that the people trying to deal with those impacts are their adversaries for some reason. It's a good that we have elections. And when your product is used in an extremely abusive way, you should take responsibility for that. And when your products have profoundly transformative applications, more than just your company and your employees should be involved in its deployment, which isn't to say that you shouldn't do it. And it isn't to say that you can't become incredibly rich in the process, but there's a responsible way to do it. And it's a lot better if that happens voluntarily instead of non-voluntarily. I think we do need legislation to hold everyone accountable to the same set of rules. I think if it's entirely voluntary, that would create a large incentive for someone to be a bad actor. And so you want to hold everyone to the same rules, but then have that create a very clear pathway for how to be extremely innovative.
So shifting gears, Daniel, do you believe there's a need for industry-specific regulations for AI, or should legislation be more broadly applicable across different sectors like the EU AI Act has? Because the healthcare folks say, hey, our industry is completely different. Education, housing, etc. What do you think?
Generally speaking, the most important models that are being developed are the foundation models, which tend to be general purpose and multimodal and have applications in every sector and industry. And so in that sense, I think it's more appropriate for regulations that are dealing with those general purpose models to target those models in particular and to think about them in a generalized way. That said, in certain very narrow areas, there are, I think, a different set of rules that will need to be worked out and applied for very particular types of harms. I think one that I think of is automated cyber attacks, where models that are particularly capable at programming will be a particular subset. And now those will have a different set of security concerns and applications, where once again, a coding language, a very, very, very good coding language model is just so insanely valuable for anyone that has it. But when we think of the idea of 100,000 servers being deployed with this bot trying to hack every American corporation by geopolitical adversaries because we open sourced the model.
Daniel, shifting to workforce and employment, there are a lot of different reports. McKinsey, IMF came out that there could be impact of 40 to 60% of our workforce, white collar jobs that could be impacted here in the US and maybe other parts of the world. And on the other hand, we've had executive order talk about that we want to be the country that attracts the best and the brightest, try to make a big push on that with tweaking immigration rules or making going out and getting them. What role do you think the U.S. Congress can play in this? This one is this huge transformation in terms of jobs, and then obviously the desire to attract AI talent from around the world to come to the U.S., because that's right now number one priority for every country. It's not just the U.S., every country. AI is becoming like it's AI nationalism, so to speak.
That's right. I think skills-based immigration, and particularly allowing AI scientists to come to the United States, would be one of the most positive narrow policies maybe we could pass, most especially because so many people want to come here. The U.S. is already the decisive global leader in AI technology, which is phenomenal for our kind of strategic position in the world, and we absolutely want to stay that way. And it makes me think of immediately following World War II. There was an awareness that there was going to be emerging race between the United States and the Soviet Union. And in response to this, the US government had this Operation Paperclip, in which German scientists were deliberately brought to the United States to work in government scientific programs with one of the most important scientists of the 20th century, Wernher von Braun, being brought to the United States, later developing the Saturn V rocket that powered many of the Apollo missions. I think there's a storied history of the way in which the United States being open to very high skill immigration, even somewhat politically questionable immigration, is a great idea for our security. And especially because the people want to come. And there, in many cases, green cards to 100 people would cause certain adversaries to not really have an AI industry anymore.
That's very interesting. Now, how about taking the other view of the displacement that's going to happen to the workers through AI? What do we do? Because when we talk about numbers like 30%, 40%, 60%, and lately you hear about even the tech companies are shedding jobs for variety. They are doing great financially, but they're shedding jobs. So what are all these workers supposed to do?
That's a really good question. There's different areas that will be impacted sooner rather than later. It's usually not too hard to see that coming. And so I would really advise workers to be strategic about what skills you're developing and be aware of the potential for automation. I think translation services and transcription services and graphic editing, a lot of these things aren't jobs anymore, though there are still people doing them. But I would say today, things like that are changing. And
customer service?
I was seeing a company that was specifically advertising their human customer service agents the other day. So I wonder whether those will stick around for premium service. My guess is that probably the AI computer customer service people will be a lot better, like way better than the human ones on average. On the labor side of things, I'm generally amenable to the idea that technology changing employment has generally been very positive. It's led to new jobs and economic growth, and everyone is, for the most part, better off, though there is significant difficulty and suffering along the way. That's not to be under. The transition from an agricultural to industrial economy was one of the most storied periods of human suffering, I would say. And I think a lot of the concern that I have with AI is that the automation happens so fast. You can deal with 1% of the population having their job fully automated, but within the next 5 years, 50% of people or something. I'm worried about basically those really rapid transitions where suddenly we reach a 50% unemployment level. My suspicion is if companies are laying off people at those levels, I don't think they quite would, because in some sense, they obviously create social problems. And in many ways, these companies are still going to be quite profitable. I think generally people that are kind of part of a company team will be less exposed than people that just have a job. And I think that the government, I think something I've seen with in Congress is this is one of the areas that there's just quite a lot of no-brainer support, that there's just going to be a lot of job retraining that's needed. It's something that government already does and invests in many ways not that well. And I think it's something we should do more of.
Okay. The government should get more involved in job retraining for the huge changes that are, as you said, about to hit us. Daniel, there have been over 100 plus bills, maybe 130 or so in Congress relating to AI. Are there any ones which you see, one or two or three, which seem the most promising from a legislation standpoint?
Yeah. The two that I wanted to point out were, the first is the Holly Blumenthal framework. Their approach is very interesting because they are using liability as one of the key ways to manage risk from these models. And that, I think that's one of the most promising approaches that we have for having companies and their investors take into account some of these issues. So we've been very supportive of a lot of the work that those offices have been doing. And the other one that I wanted to point out, and this is not a bill that's been introduced yet, though Senator Cantwell, there was some information from her recently, that Senate Leader Schumer has really put AI legislation on the agenda for this year and is going to have more information coming from his office. I don't know what that information is, but I think his leadership and the forthcoming bill that we'll see from his office and the partners involved with him, I think that's probably going to be the most important AI legislative effort this year and is something to really pay close attention to in terms of what direction US AI regulations are going.
So, final question to have you look at your crystal ball. Are we going to have comprehensive AI legislation this year? I mean, you just said Senator Schumer is going to have something out, because we're going to have you come back 6 months later.
I think...
I'm just kidding. We want your prediction. It doesn't matter.
I think that it is looking very promising. Some people might say different things, but I think Republican and Democratic leadership wants it. And different components of AI legislation are getting it across the line. I think the deepfake nudes, the election interference issues, these are demonstrating and providing lessons to Congress that this technology is starting to have some impacts. And it's really good to get out ahead of this, because something that I've heard a whole bunch of different members say is, we really let social media get out from under us. The harms scaled, our society transformed. We're living in a totally different world now. And government didn't really even move. It didn't even really do much along the way. And that isn't the way that I think people would have wanted that to go. And no one wants to repeat that with AI.
Okay. We will be watching very closely, and we'll be looking forward to getting you back here. But Daniel, final remarks to our audience, which is members of Congress, their staff, think tanks, and it's global industry, civil rights advocates. It's your closing remarks for them, sir.
The final thing I'll say is just, we're in a really interesting moment, seeing this technology coming, but having it not quite here yet. And it's hard to be creative enough and imaginative enough to figure out what the future might look like. And I just find it so illustrative to think back to past technologies and how impossible it is to imagine how transformative those things can be, and let yourself get a little bit creative with AI. It seems like the technology we're getting is an automation of intelligence. An automation of intelligence, it means that the thing that humans are good at, now the machines are good at it. You know, we named ourselves Homo sapiens, the smart ape. But we're not going to be the smart one anymore. We're going to be the slow one relative to the AI. And that really changes what it means to be human. And it changes whether or not we're the most powerful ones around. These are really hard and big questions. And I think just definitely we shouldn't be forced to make them fast. And we shouldn't be letting the people that are most incentivized to do so in irresponsible ways, because they'll benefit from doing it that way. I just cautioned that they're not always the right ones to listen to. They know a lot about the technology, but a lot of the time they don't actually even know that much about the societal impacts, because they haven't really thought about it. They've been thinking about the technology. And we need to think really hard and carefully about where we go from here.
Think really hard and carefully where we go from here. Some great thoughts, some scary thoughts from you also, to think of, as you said, we're not only smart ones around here, maybe less smart in some ways. But we had a very smart one on our podcast today. Daniel, thanks so much. This was really good. We covered a lot of ground. I could have gone on for hours on so many different topics, but we'll have you back again here. Thank you for taking the time, Daniel.
Thank you much, Sanjay. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI Innovate Responsibly podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on the show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode, and leave us a 5-star review.